Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, U-N-I-F-Y-D, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
What do you think about the Laker team now?
You follow the box scores, the games every day.
Just the Lakers.
You're kidding. That is really a compliment. I was pleased to see you smile at the top of our show, because once the game starts, you have a game face. You don't smile much out there.
I don't think you have to do things for money anymore.
Correct.
What's up, Laker fans? Welcome to the Laker Film Room Podcast, brought to you by the Blue Wire Podcast Network. I'm Pete, joined by Darius and Mike. And today we're going to get to a number of your mailbag questions. But first, some news out of Boston. Ime Udoka is suspended by the organization for a full season over a relationship with another team employee. Guys, I don't want to get too into details about a story that we don't know much about the actual allegations. So let's approach this just simply from the basketball perspective. Mike, this is not the best news for a team to get going into training camp.
Yeah, certainly not. And I think that the first thing that stood out to me was the reporting on it, I thought was a little careless. In like, it's one thing to break news and to try to be first when there's a trade or something like mm-hmm. that. But it's another when you don't have the complete picture and you're just putting out a morsel on Twitter. And then there are people that have real life consequences of that. For example, being a woman in that organization that had right. nothing to do with this. And then right. all of a sudden you're getting tweets. Oh, is it this person? Is it that person? People going to the Celtics website, seeing what females are on staff. So that part I thought was really in poor taste. And I felt that those are the people that I feel the worst for, the people in that organization that had to deal with speculation. As for whoever was involved, you know, that's where we also don't have the details to find out exactly what, you know, if it's at first it was consensual and then it wasn't. And I know that's not what we're here to. I shouldn't say then it wasn't. Then more complicating factors came out in Shams' piece last night about how, well, it started that way. And then, but we're not sure what the dynamic was. So that part is just messy. As for how it affects kind of Udoka and the Celtics, to me, I don't know how you come back from that with just a suspension. To me, that's just something because of the power dynamic, because there are only a couple of people in the organization, right, that are, it would be the president, the GM, and then the head coach, the kind of the front-facing people. To have a coworker that is, in that sense, subservient, that to me is just pretty complicated. And it's hard to just go back and win the locker room back over. So that's the one thing. Then they had the Robert Williams injury and the Gallinari injury. So it's a tough media day, certainly going in there. But yeah, Darius, that was the first thing that stood out to me. I just was uncomfortable with the whole way the thing was being covered. And still, we don't even have all the details in some of the other people that are having to endure this there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this whole thing is just messy and ugly in its own way. And there's a bunch of things that we'll probably never know. And even the things that we do know now are not clarified to the point that I actually feel informed. Right. Yeah. And so going back, actually, and this is where I feel like we as media consumers are also culpable in our own way because of our thirst for information and our sort of Pavlovian response to a breaking news sort of tweet. And even mm-hmm. the way that this tweet, the original tweet, the Woj tweet, was set up as like breaking news. Like, that triggers this lizard part of our brain where we are then hungry for every morsel of information that we could get, when in reality, the nature of this report required much more of a human touch to it all, that I don't think the reporting has played out that way at all. And that's the reporting part of this that troubles me most, because on its face, Woj's original tweet of this guy basically broke team rules and he's going to be suspended, that's actually what happened, right? And so,
right.
But the way it was presented as, here's like this ominous picture of the head coach, and here's a picture of me and my at symbol from Twitter, and then breaking news, like that sirens all over the, like it just sort of, like I said, it is set up in a way where we are then thirsty for a story in a way that we probably should not be thirsty for it at all, right? Because of the human implications and all of the relationship within that organization, not the relationship with Udoka and like everything that happened, but like the need for more privacy around stuff like this, I think is super important. And unfortunately, like the way that this rolled out, it was like a trade, and it wasn't a trade.
Right. Right.
And so that's sort of my take on the reporting aspect of this, is that we live in a culture of like first, like be first. Yeah. And I've said this to almost every editor I've ever written for. I've said this to you guys behind the scenes. And it's just like an ethos of mine as someone who tangentially works in media. Right. Like, I'm not a journalist. I didn't go to journalism school. I didn't go to Medill like Mike. I'm not highly trained. Right. It's like I'm not one of those dudes. But I would rather be right and offer as much context as I possibly can and make sure that I'm being as informative as I can when I'm touching on a story, rather than be first on something. Now, that's because I'm some lowly dude and I don't make my bones off of being the newsbreaker, I guess. But when you peddle in that world, it is, I think you set yourself up to navigate these situations in a certain way, and it gets trickier. And so that's just my two cents on reporting in general and all of that. Pete, if you want to jump in here, please, please guys, do, because there is a basketball element that I do think matters.
No, I mean, the reporting element of it is, you guys know and have been on the receiving end of a lot of my rants on how both sports, but also, you know, the world and just media in general is, you know, covers events. And we're at a place where it's far more entertainment than it is informative. And providing information is a public service, right? The whole point of reporting and of journalism is to tell stories to people as accurately as possible and relay information. But it's a very corruptible place as well. And it's something where there's no real enforcement mechanism on telling the truth. There are a lot of really good journalists who toil away in not particularly high paying jobs. And then the ones who know how to play the game and know how to grease the wheels and do it rather cynically tend to do pretty well for themselves as well. So that's something that I'm glad you guys actually took this angle with it. We can talk about the basketball elements at a different time, but I'm actually really glad that it went in this direction, and that just, we have a general responsibility, I think, as people who covered the league tangentially or otherwise, to do so in good faith and to try to the best that we can provide the facts and not use it simply as a cynical like mechanism of gaining followers and likes and retweets and just hitting that dopamine every, you know, time and time again, right? The of that, like, oh, breaking news. Oh, I need more and more gossip. And so I'm glad that we touched on this first.
Yeah, I think it's tricky too, because the idea of a head coach being suspended for up to a year, that's important.
Unprecedented.
And it's unprecedented, right? And so I definitely understand the worthiness of that as news. The tricky part is why? And if you're not going to reveal why, then how are you going to contextualize it further? And there was a lot of nuance that I feel like that fell short for me in this specific case. And that's just a tricky thing. And I'm not here to like try to dunk on Woj or like to try to dunk on Shams, whose follow-ups did provide more context, but did not provide enough context to where it seemed like it was almost contradicted in the report that came out the next day by him as well. And so there's a lot of stuff here that is just like, it's messy. The reporting was not as clean as I would have liked as a consumer of media, and particularly a consumer of basketball media, and someone who feels like this needs to be, everyone needs to be held to as high a standard as possible. And I bet if you gave both these guys the truth serum, they might tell you that they wished it could have, that it would have been cleaner themselves, right? But it's just like, this is the nature of the world, Mike, where it is like, let's get the news out and then we'll deal with it later. And that's a tough world to live in when it comes to this specific type of story, where all like the devil really is in the details, and the details really do matter, and you really do need to tread carefully, because like our thirst for that is going to lead to a bunch of I will not curse here, but pardon my language, like effing bozos and clowns that then jump online and are like, yeah, let's publish pictures and names and let's speculate on who, what's going on and who these people are. And like, let's cape up for everyone in the organization. Or if like whatever, everyone starts to take their stance, and it's just an ugly, ugly thing. And I just wish we were all better. All of us. I say that as like the royal we, like we need to be better about stuff like this. And this was a case where I just wish that we were, and we weren't. And I think everyone sort of fell short in their own way in this.
Yeah, so I just saw something. I only read about two paragraphs of it, but Brad Stevens talking about how badly he feels for the women in the organization and echoing that. And there's only so much they can say. And the issue is, right, well, if they had just named the person that it was, it ends the speculation, but that's a privacy issue as well. And then depending on again, the way that it was initiated and whatever the relationship was, that's the stuff that we don't know. So we won't speculate on it any further, certainly. I'm now just thinking of to quickly try to turn it to basketball is just Boston, I thought, came out of the finals as a clear finals, not necessarily favorite, but right up there. In Vegas, mm-hmm. I think had them as favorites as recently as a week ago. But then not only do you have the Gallinari injury, even if he wasn't going to play a ton in crunch time or that kind of thing, and much more significantly to me is the Robert Williams injury and how different they were. And how when he wasn't on the floor, they weren't able to provide the proper deterrent to Golden State. And those are the times where Golden State really had their way with them. And like I think adding Udoka into this and just all of the drama and all of that, I do think is enough to knock them down a peg or two, right? Like these kinds of things, when it's already a tight race and it's not some overwhelming talent difference, Pete, you know, to me that does change where I would rank them in the East going into this season, just the cumulative effect of those last really 3-4 weeks of bad news for them.
Udoka proved himself to be a really good head coach. So like put all this stuff aside, right? He was,
he had the buy-in of all those guys. Yeah. Especially Tatum and Brown. And
yeah. He showed to be like a leader for them in a way that mattered. And one of the things that he did is like, he outcoached Steve Nash, like in the first round. Now, how high of a bar that it is or whatever, it's just like he did an excellent job as a head coach in terms of getting his team to the point where they were in the NBA finals and up at one point in the series 2-1, right? And so I think losing your head coach and losing him for these specific reasons, but losing him at all, it's that's enough to me as a believer in how much coaching actually does matter in this league, that it's rough for the Celtics. Like, I don't know another way to frame it from a basketball standpoint.
It leaves them in an odd position too, from a, so the guy who's taken over for him, I think his name's Mazzella. the guy who's taken over for him, does he run Udoka's system? Probably, right? The closest thing that comes to this is, remember when Steve Kerr was out a couple years ago with the back issue and Luke Walton filled in for him? And then that's something that is so established that I think that you kind of keep the trains running, and that's pretty much what the goal is. And they're probably going to try to replicate that in Boston as well. But trying to run someone else's system with someone else's vision is very different than supporting it. So they certainly have some challenges ahead. And I talk a lot about the idea of building a wave going into a season and throughout a season. And it always doesn't always work that way, right? Like last year, they were an under 500 team in January, and it snapped into place and they turned things around. But it's something that the more accumulation of things like this early on, the tougher that it can be. So let's take a quick break and shift gears. When we come back, we're going to answer some of your mailbag questions.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
All right, guys, some Lakers stuff. This question comes from Riley Lewis. In a Russ-centric unit, let's say a bench group, who do you think is the better option at the five offensively, Jones or Bryant? I like Jones's motor and athleticism as a roller, but there's also a good argument that Russ operates better with a pick-and-pop big to create more driving lanes. Mike, what say you on the Jones versus Bryant alongside Russ?
Okay, so the Russ qualifier, right, is important because that certainly impacts what that situation is going to be. I still, though, would just defer to how Bryant and Jones look individually first, because if there's a big gap in how they look in preseason, then, you know, I don't care who's the slightly better fit with the way that Russ plays. But like the clear answer, if we're assuming that Jones and Bryant are pretty close, then the clear answer would be Bryant, because you need that spacing. You need some of that shooting to extend out to the perimeter, I think. Now, that doesn't, you know, Russ obviously could also have the lob threat in Jones. So there's a part of that. But for me, just with the way defenses would play, if Russ were going to start and if Jones were going to start, that it would be so packed in the paint already that I would probably defer to the shooting in that sense. But so, yeah, that would be my overarching thought. But I'm still kind of more thinking about which guy looks better than who fits with Russ.
My preference would actually be Jones, provided that the other three guys can shoot. It's more about like what can the five-man group do, and Riley said in the question, like, let's say a bench unit. So we're not talking about a LeBron and AD group. We're talking an either or. I'm guessing that Darvin is going to have one of them out there at all times. And so either or with a bench unit, it's, you know, if it's LeBron out there, it's probably Jones. And also in part because they can – but. Yeah, but then that's the case. If it's LeBron and Jones, like, just have them run middle ball screens, right, and have shooting around them. But if – yeah, that's kind of where I'm at. And so on this team, D, though, like, I'm talking about that from a theoretical standpoint. If the other three guys can shoot, well, we don't really have a ton of shooting. And so if it's other guys that it's going to be that easy decision, like Mike was talking about, of packing the paint, and because I'm not going to close out to Juan Toscano-Anderson, right? I'm totally going to tag on Damian Jones on a roll instead of that. It's very much dependent on the surrounding talent, but in a vacuum, I'd probably prefer Jones. But also Mike's point about like who looks better now, I think one of the things that's going to come into play is Thomas Bryant's coming off of an injury, right? He played a little bit last year, but when he returned from a pretty major knee injury, and so where he's at in that development and in like, I think that we've been kind of assuming, and I've been certainly guilty of this, that he's going to get back to the year two or year three Thomas Bryant that was really good with Washington, right? And because he's only 25, 26 years old. It's not something where there's some erosion of talent because he's gotten older or anything, but sometimes there's an erosion due to injury. So I think that what we've been expecting out of Thomas Bryant and what he may be might be two different things.
So I'm actually leaning towards Jones as well. So I look at this as who has more guaranteed gravity, because any sort of rust pick and roll, you're looking at how much gravity does the screener have in order to allow rust to get downhill more. And I think Jones is going to have more gravity as a lob threat than Bryant is going to have gravity as a 3-point shooter. And Bryant's sure going to have to shoot a high volume of threes, and he's going to have to make them. And then even then, as a pick and pop big, there are ways to scheme where you're actually rotating from the perimeter to him rather than having his own man recover out. And so I look at this as, if Jones is getting downhill and rolling hard, he's going to need to be tagged.
Yep.
Especially if Russ is turning the corner and looking to get downhill, which he is. If there's one thing we know about Russ, he is going to put his head down, even if it's reckless, even if it's not necessarily the right play.
He's going to get into the paint. Yeah,
he's going to try to get downhill, and he's going to try to draw the next defender. That's just how he plays. So I'm looking at this from a gravity standpoint, and I guess initially my answer would be, until proven otherwise, Jones. Because I think Jones is going to have more roll gravity than Bryant is going to have pop gravity, which I think will help Russ more. But that's speculation. But that's sort of where I'm at this point.
All right. Our next question comes from Matt. This is a good question. This is something I think is more important than the starting lineup. Matt asks, what do you see as the Lakers' best closing lineup?
Closing, I think it is AD at the five. And then obviously LeBron. I need Patrick Beverley. I need Austin Reeves, and well, if he's healthy and I feel like I can go small enough, then maybe I try to get away with Kendrick Nunn. But this is the point where I'd rather have some more size, like one of those mid-sized guys that just isn't really on the roster, you know?
Right.
So if that's is where a Kuz or a Markieff Morris or somebody that can slide between LeBron and AD when needed, and that's the spot that I don't have. I still don't think that I want the other big out there, though. And so then it becomes a who's playing best, essentially, between his Juan Toscano-Anderson hit a couple threes that game. You know, is Troy Brown particularly on it defensively? Is Kendrick Nunn taking advantage of a matchup? So that part is unclear, and I guess that's why I'll go, if the other team I know is also small, then I'd probably go with Kendrick Nunn. And if not, then, you know, whichever one of those forwards is playing well enough, I would throw in.
So for me, I think the answer is between Dennis and Damian Jones.
Yeah, I should have mentioned Dennis too. Yeah, thank you for doing that, Darius. Yeah,
do you have the other two? Do you have Pat Bev and Austin in the closing lineup?
I have Austin for sure. And I mean, yeah, I would probably lean towards Beverly. So three guys I want to see close as much as possible are LeBron, AD, and Austin. I think that Austin is the player who's proven to play best off of those guys. We will see if Dennis is still there with that. And we'll see how Nunn plays off of those guys as well. I sort of have it baked in that Beverly will be fine. And I think his defense will be important in late game situations regardless. And so he'd probably be there like 80% of the time.
And this is trusting Darius that Beverly's not going to, you know, look off LeBron and pull up for three too often, which can
happen.
It's going to happen with him, Mike. And those are times when, you know, that's where he isn't always in it, but yeah, presuming that he's behaving.
Yeah. And look, like, I still haven't gone on my long, like, Beverly rant in terms of, like, the things I don't like about his game. Like, antics aside, the things I don't like about his game. But that's sort of where I'd be. I wouldn't, like, if Beverly is going to defend a lot of, like, twos and threes, and if in late game situations LeBron and AD can guard the best wing and the best big, then that gives you a lot of versatility and ability to play smaller dudes with them, even if it is Dennis, Beverly, and Austin, I think, because you have enough with those guys as well from a perimeter defensive ability standpoint to say, we got it. We could do enough with this group. And so I would probably lean in that direction if I was going small, and I would swap out either Dennis or Patrick Beverly, probably for Jones as a big guy at this point, if the Lakers were going to close with a bigger group.
That's one of the things, like Mike was saying earlier, that you'd love to have another bigger forward out there as next to LeBron and AD, but that guy just simply isn't on the roster. And in lieu of that, when you do need to go a little bit bigger, I do think that there are going to be more games where it is Jones or TB that's closing and AD is closing at the four, which has not been the case in the past. Just as an absence of that, you know, backup 3-4 type of guy that can slide into that spot with in a closing lineup, I think that that's just going to happen a little bit more often. With my closing five, the three guys that have that are written in pen are LeBron, AD, and Pat Bev. Austin is certainly a candidate for one of the closing spots, but he's one of a group of him, Nunn, Russ, and Dennis, most likely, that would be filling those two spots. So it's four guys for those final two spots. And so there are going to be some nights where I think Dennis, Pat Bev, and Russ are the way to go. Other nights where it's going to be Nunn, Austin, and Pat Bev. But Pat Bev was the one guy amongst the role players that I kind of have written in pen for that position.
And frankly, even when the Lakers won the title, LeBron and AD were the only 100% for sure guys that were closing.
Yes.
Danny Green was many, many times more often than not. But even early in the season, like, it wasn't KCP yet. Alex Caruso, it ended up emerging some. You know, sometimes it could have been Kuz, sometimes it was Markieff Morris. So you don't, when you've got guys that are that good.
Rondo closed a bunch of games too, where it was just like, oh my God, Rondo, like, Frank, what are you doing? Frank?
Guys, that was very atypical in the NBA. Like, usually you have at least four guys that are almost always going to be out there to close games. Like, like, look at what, you know, Phoenix's roster, or, you know, even Golden State or Boston. Like, it's usually going to be the same guys. And I would typically like to see that, but that team just, they had such a, and this is why I bring it up for this context, because if you have other guys that will do whatever the role is needed around the two that everybody agrees on, or the guys, you can do it that way too. And so this is going to be a fluid question. It's a good question, but the reason that we all went on and mentioned, you know, eight different guys is because it's really not, it's not clear, nor is it going to be clear. There's not, I don't think Darvin's going to be like, this is the closing group, right, for every game.
Exactly. And that's something, like you said, is super unusual. Most other teams, you know who their closing five is going to be. Our friend of the pod, Mike Garcia, in our conversations, that's something he's really big on, is that you know, you get yourself a closing lineup and you build your team around that. And then you build backwards off of that. And so I'm going to be very curious to see what Darvin ends up doing. All right, guys, we got a fun one here from Andres Garcia asks, probably too late for this one. It is not, but I'll try anyway. I know Darius and Pete also grew up on Showtime. How'd it make you guys feel seeing those Maui videos? My inner child was so happy seeing my heroes all back together and having fun. Mike, you've had a little bit more insight on what's going on in Maui. Talk to us.
Well, Michael Thompson had been texting us on the group thread, right? With various and consistent updates. Yes, Riggs, I'm going to go ahead and skip the ad for you to get Disney Sing-Along back on. There you go. Thought, figured I'd just let you in on what was going on while I was talking there. That was going to be impossible. So Michael's sending us these videos. And the first several are when everybody got in the first night. And basically, they all got up to introduce themselves and their family. And of course, everyone knew who they were. But hey, Bob McAdoo, come on up, you know. And, well, this is who I brought. This is what's been going on. McAdoo took a shot at Magic, which was hilarious. And Magic goes into his deep belly laugh. And so I'm just getting these videos in one by one and then forwarding them onto YouTube, knowing that you're the two people in my phone that are going to probably appreciate this more than anybody. And so that's the background of it. I mean, I'm really looking forward to Backstage Lakers is going to do two behind. Well, I think I should say for sure, but I assume they'll do at least like two full shows, right? Behind the scenes, they had multiple cameras there, and those will be great. So make sure to check out Spectrum when those things come out. But yeah, I mean, you guys, like I said, I was watching them and enjoying them, but I felt like I was more just doing it to to hit your childhood. So, you know, hopefully that was fun for you guys.
That was, you were very successful in that. And thank you for passing those videos on, man. There are some times where I think that I died in the hospital a couple of years ago and I'm living this like Laker fan heaven dream, like, you know, working for the team and then getting these videos sent by Mike, you know, from behind the scenes. And it was so cool, the videos that you sent, just kind of seeing them in their own element. And there were a couple that stood out, a couple especially revolving around Pat Riley. One where he was talking crap to Michael about how Clay makes more money than him in 1 year than Michael ever made in his whole career. That's how guys like kind of talk crap to each other, right? And Riley's still just such a presence. And then another one of him addressing the team that really hit me, that he was talking about how, like, you don't realize, like, he's like, we didn't realize how great we were at the time. Like, you don't realize you're part of something special when you're in the moment of it. It takes that time, D, that kind of letting it process and settle and reflecting back on it, that especially with like Kareem turning 75 and just everyone's getting older. That's another thing that stands out. It's like, these guys are all old men. I grew up with them and they're all old guys, you know? And so it certainly makes me feel older. That's one of those things that seeing someone else age, you know, has a way of doing that. But that really stood out to me, Dee, is Riley's comments to the team just about like reflecting back on that era and how when you're in it doing the work, you don't really have the proper appreciation for it. But then when you look back on it, you do.
Yeah, I think the thing that has stood out to me the most is A, how many of them were able to come, and just the sheer like, oh, like there's 20, 25 players.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And it sort of shows the extent of their run, like how long they were a great team. And yeah, the guys who were there at the beginning but then left, like Norm Nixon, or were there towards the end and but not at the beginning, like even a Michael Thompson, right? And how all of these guys share that brotherhood and that connectivity based off of the idea that there were those core guys that traveled together over the course of almost the entire time. Like Magic, Kareem, and Cooper were there the entire time, right? And then Worthy was there from 82 on. And then even Rambis was there for an extended period of time too. And just that idea of having those guys be the anchors. And Mike, I know that you've done this before. Like, I think you told us before about how you've like taken trips and met up with your old college buddies. And like, these are guys who you've known for 10, 15, 20 years. And it's like that idea of those lasting friendships. And it just shows you that like the brotherhood that exists with these guys and everything that they accomplished together, and Riley being right there with them, and all of their affinity for Riley as well, as like the guy who, remember, like Riley took over that team when he was relatively young. Players did not play as long as they play now. There weren't 40-year-old guys littered across the league, or guys who played 17, 18, 19, 20 seasons the way that they do now. And so Riley had been retired, but he was young still, right? Like he was. So when he took over the team and he started to coach, it's just like his maturity level and him growing into the role of being Pat Riley, the Don, the guy that we see now. But he's like a peer to so many of them in terms of age, right? Like he's not so much older than Kareem.
Right.
Right. So it's like that idea too of now the way that when you grow up, you sort of look at your parents and like they'll always be your parents and they'll always be that authority figure to you in a certain way. But as you age, you're like, oh, I'm going to talk to you like an adult because I'm an adult and you raised me to be this adult. And now we relate on all of these different levels. And so it was all of that sort of background stuff that I appreciated about as well, is like, look at these men who accomplished so much together in their youth, but now 20, 30, 40 years later, it's just like, they're still like, they could just recall it like riding a bike and those memories just flood back and you could see the genuine love and appreciation and respect that they all had for each other. And so that was really great.
And the other thing, time is such a precious commodity. And I think it's evolved a little bit too with the modern NBA team and how everybody has their cell phone. And that's kind of the thing that you go check at halftime and after the game and on the bus, everyone's listening to headphones. And you know, these guys, they were just around each other all day. They practiced every day. They sat on the buses together. They had no, I mean, sure, Kareem would be reading a newspaper, you know, but that would be it. And they just talked trash to each other. And they spent a massive percentage of their 20s and early 30s together, these guys. And sure, a guy comes in, but then he's connected to one player on a different team. And it's just the relationships that they had make it for such kind of quick developing fondness. And so that's when Darius mentioned, so yeah, if I go to see my college friends, well, the thing is, when we were there for those 4 years, the time that we spent together was so great that we can go a couple of years without talking much or seeing each other and you fall right back in. And I think some people that have big families have this kind of thing where everybody's sort of around the house always growing up. And then you go back into town, you might not have seen the crew for a while and you drop into that. And that's part of, I think, what that Showtime Lakers crew had. And that's part of what makes special relationships.
It's beautiful. And I can't wait to see what Backstage ends up doing with it. All right, everyone, have a great weekend. When we talk to you again, it will be after Media Day. So it won't be a Monday morning pod. We'll try to record either Monday night or Tuesday morning. But until then, you've been listening to the Laker Film Room podcast. We'll catch you guys next time.
Ainge has got it in low to McHale. McHale wants to turn. He's double teamed. Just pass out of front, broken up by Worthy. Tip to Magic. Worthy dies on his belly. Magic scores.
And Magic got it. Magic fires. It's good. And the Lakers win the game. The Lakers win the game. Rebound to Lonnie. 3 seconds left. Van Exel to win it. It's on the way. Good.
Kobe Bryant, 48 points, 16 rebounds. Shaq with his eighth block shot that ties an NBA Finals record.
A lot of Laker fans sticking around for this.
You're seeing something that's very rare indeed. A Laker to get MVP chance
right, in Boston.
In Boston.
Of all places.
Are you kidding me?
Kobe, hard to believe.
Are you kidding me? Unreal. Are you kidding me?
Lakers looking to push. Bryant spinning in the lane. Back for Gasol. Ready pass. And it's back to a three-point game.
Kobe Bryant picked up by Bell.
There's the move. Two, one. Miss it.
Unbelievable.
For the victory.
It's over.
Shot clock now to five. Bryant. Yes.
And that was a little tough to Alvin Gentry.
Add insult to injury, Kobe. I mean, what a shot. I mean, you can't defend that. Are you kidding me?
2.1 seconds remaining. Denver a foul to give. Jokic trying to disrupt Rondo. He puts it in. Here's Davis, 4-3 in the win. Oh, it's good. Anthony Davis has won it for the Lakers. James again. Oh, he hits another one. LeBron James putting together a closing quarter against the Nuggets.
This historic 2020 NBA championship belongs to the Los Angeles Lakers. The Lakers conquer the bubble, and banner number 17 will soon hang in the rafters.